welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June the 3rd, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Chuck Huff. The title of his series, Psych Fallacies. Today's session is entitled, Character is Everything. Let's listen in.
What I wanted to do in a series of talks and conversations is to talk about common psychological fallacies, and that is things that most of us think is true with regard to psychology, and yet if you look closely at the research and if you think carefully about things, you find either that things are more complicated than the common wisdom, or in some cases that the common wisdom is just flat wrong. So I have a list of, I'm going to do five this week and then five next week. I saved some of my really fun ones for next week because my fiance is coming in soon. We're going to get married next week on Friday. And so all of her relatives are going to be here, so I want to have some of my good talks for those days. We're out of here, that's right.
Here at Holden?
Yeah, I'm going to get married here, hopefully in the Village Green, if the weather is kind to us.
Everybody invited?
Everybody's invited.
All right, good.
That wouldn't be a Holden event if everybody...
Did you bring a cigar?
No, I didn't bring any cigars.
Too much fire hazard.
But let's see. Let me tell you a little bit about my background and why I'm interested in these things. I'm what's called a social psychologist, which is a psychologist who studies how people get along with each other, or don't, as the case may be, how people think about each other and interact, how groups work, how organizations work, those sorts of things. So I'm not a clinical psychologist or a counselor. And I don't do therapy with individuals or with groups. What I do is bring people sometimes into a laboratory, and we'll talk some about laboratory experiments that I or some other social psychologists have done. I read some of the research that other people have done. And sometimes I do some applied work, like helping schools or organizations do group work or team building or that sort of thing. So the first thing I wanted to get out of the way is that I'm not a clinical psychologist. If you'd like to talk to me about something you feel bad about, I'll be happy to, but I'm not qualified.
But you wouldn't charge us either, then.
Right? That's right, but I wouldn't charge you. And I would charge what it was worth. So. So my expertise on these topics comes mainly from doing research and reading research and some application in organizations. All of you have expertise in things psychological. You get along with people reasonably well. So I don't want to act like I'm the expert in the room. I have probably read a little more widely than most of you in things psychological. However, I suspect there's lots of stuff in psychology that you've read that I've not seen. And so if you have something interesting you want to bring up that you've read or some thoughts that you have about things, I'm ready to listen. Here's one reason I'm very interested in y'all's thoughts on this series. I'm thinking about putting together this series in a book form as a book for everyday folks, not other psychologists, to talk about these kinds of issues, places where we think we know what's going on when in fact things are more complicated than they seem at first. And so I'd like to get feedback from y'all about whether you think these topics ring true, if they're helpful, where they might be off, ways that I might be able to change them a little bit to apply to the particular situations that you know about? Any stories or thoughts that you have about how these things work into your life or other people's lives? So one of the reasons I want to do this is to get feedback from folks about some of these thoughts. But, you know, if we disagree on something, what I'd like us to do is to take that as an opportunity to say, ooh, something cool is going on. Let's talk about what may be happening. And I'm gonna do my best to be open to the psychological reality that you see. And I would ask that you do your best to be open to some of the things that I'm talking about. Sometimes these topics are going to get a little touchy in that way. So I would appreciate your cooperation in being open. Let's see. The first one I wanted to do, partly because it's basic and I'm going to refer back to it a lot, is the idea that character is everything. When we talk about politicians running for office, we always talk about the character issue. Well, what is his or her character? How good a person are they? When we think about when we do our own personal devotions, often what we're attempting to do is to improve our character. Personality, increase our patience, increase our insight, make ourselves better listeners, all these sorts of personality traits. When we reflect on ourselves as good or bad people, usually what we do is reflect on our personality traits. How good a person am I? And if I do something bad, does that mean I'm a bad person? When we explain other people's behavior, we usually explain their behavior in terms of the personality characteristics they have. So we see someone, you see me talking to a group, and you assume probably that I'm an extrovert because I get up in front of groups and talk. That's not a bad assumption, but at least from the official tests that I've taken, I'm not. But I have the skills of standing up to talk in front of people because I get paid for it, and I had to learn how. So when people do bad things, when people fight wars with each other, when people massacre populations in Bosnia or in various countries in Africa, what we try, usually the first thing we leap to is the character of those individuals. Those are bad people who did those things. And what I'd like to suggest in maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and then we can open the floor up, is that that story is far too simple. An explanation of the kinds of things that go on. That in fact, character is a part of it, but there are at least two other issues that make things more complicated. And then based on those issues, I want to give one footnote about our responsibility. So let me start. The first one that I'd like you to think about is that personality, yours or mine, or someone else's, is not a unitary thing. It's not a single, coherent set of traits. So, however often we assume that is, that that's the truth. So, for instance, it's been shown that people who are better looking, who are more attractive, are more likely to be found innocent in courts of law. The psychologists, after having looked at that effect several times, have called that the beautiful is good. So So if you look nice, this is why lawyers dress their clients up, to make them look nice, and don't want them coming in their jail clothes. Because the nicer you look, the more your chances are of being found innocent. Now, that story is a whole lot more complicated than that, and if you're interested, we can get into it. Very often, if we see someone do a bad thing, we assume that they're bad people. And that, so, for instance, many people are surprised when they find out that Hitler was one of the originators of the animal rights movement. He was very much a proponent of animal rights, and was a strong supporter of the animal rights movement in Germany. This is not to say that I think the things that Hitler did were good. It's to say that any story about anybody's personality, even somebody as manifestly bad as Hitler, is more complex than we're often likely to give it. We do this with our presidential candidates. If we don't like our presidential candidates' politics, we often assume that they must be unfaithful, or that they must be doing shady deals. Or if we find out that they're doing shady deals, we think they must be doing politics bad. And so we have this now in Washington, this constant search for scandal. Because if you disagree with the other person's politics, well, they must be bad people. And we find this in churches, too, people who disagree about doctrine. You assume that people who are different from you, who differ from you on doctrinal issues, must have some reason that's evil or at least sneaky for their disagreement. So we assume that personality is unitary, that good people have all good traits and bad people have all bad traits. Now, those of us who've gotten close to anybody know that that's not true. But it's only when we take the time to get close enough to somebody that we find that that's not true. It's also only when we spend enough time with people that we find out that personality can change over time. People who take the Myers-Briggs inventory can have their scores change on the Myers-Briggs. So it's not like you're always, I don't know that Myers-Briggs, an NJTP or whatever they are. You can change. People, particularly if you're towards the middle of those scales. People treat those, by the way, as though they're dichotomous. You're either an introvert or an extrovert. But in fact, it's a continuous scale. Let me give you an interesting example from a book that I would recommend you pick up. Dan, do you know if it's in the bookstore? I haven't checked. Shantung Compound?
It has been.
It has in the past.
It's currently on.
Shantung Compound is by a fellow who was caught in World War II in China and was imprisoned by the Japanese along with a whole bunch of other Europeans. And they were given a compound and for most of the time were able to run their lives themselves reasonably autonomously. They couldn't leave. But they were able to set up their own democratic governing procedures, those sorts of things. And this is a book about this person's experience during World War II in the compounds and the psychological aspects of that experience. So how people took that, how people behaved under this kind of pressure, how groups got along. Towards the end of World War II, when they were running, when the Japanese were running out of food, it got pilfering from the kitchens reached record heights, even among, you know, friends. Folks would go in because, of course, they felt that they needed the food for their children, or because they were doing extra work. And there was one group, there were several kitchens, and there was one group that had no pilfering. And that's because there was a trustworthy fellow who would sleep every night in the kitchen and keep people from pilfering the food. The fascinating thing that that Gilkey points out in this section where he's talking about the pilfering is that this fellow was thought of as a bad character. He was a drunk and generally thought of as irresponsible. But he wouldn't steal food. He would do other irresponsible things, but he wouldn't steal food. And so here I think is a fascinating example of an individual who has a shining character that was quite useful for this group, but might not have quite so great a reputation in other areas. And these are kinds of issues we might want to discuss as we talk about how we treat each other, how we treat each other within churches. The second thing that I wanted to bring up is that, so the first one was that personality isn't unitarian, so we can't assume that character is immovable, unchangeable. And the second one is that situations are really more important than we think in determining the good and the bad that we do. Looking at this particular issue is a place where social psychologists shine particularly. So I want to talk about two studies that some social psychologists have done to look at the power of situations on people's moral, influencing people's moral behavior. The first one is a series of studies done by Stanley Milgram that some of you may have heard of, in which he had people shock other folks, or at least think that they were shocking other people. Milgram was interested in this partly because he had escaped from Germany and come to the United States before the World War started, and was appalled at the kind of evil that the Nazis perpetrated in the concentration camps. And he asked himself, how can people do these things? Are they all, do we have to think of the Nazi concentration camp guards and officers and all of those folks as evil people? How do we explain what they've done? And so Milgram set up a situation in which people were asked to be obedient and to harm someone else. And that's the situation is the one that I've got drawn up here on the board. And if anybody listens to the tape can't see, that's just life. This is a study that was initially done at Yale, but he has done this series of studies in other circumstances too. And again, we can unpack this more later if you're interested. He would bring people in with an ad and offer them $5. This was the 1960s, so it was a reasonable amount of money to participate in a study. He got a broad cross-section of the population to come into the Yale experimental laboratories and participate in a study that they thought was on the use of punishment in learning. Instead, what the study was about was how much punishment they would offer somebody, they would give to somebody, when the experimenter was telling them that they had to. So imagine yourself in this experiment. You've answered an ad. You show up for the experiment. A very clean-cut, serious-looking experimenter greets you at the laboratory, has you sign a consent form saying that you understand what's going on and that you're willing to participate. You then meet the other person who's in the study, and you think they're just another volunteer just like you were. You draw from a hat to find out who's going to do what roles. You find out that your role is to be the teacher, and that the other person's role is to be the learner. the job of the teacher is to teach the learner a series of paired words like blue, bird, sun, rise, these sorts of, and they were very easy. The experimenter explains to you that they're interested in the effects of punishment on people's ability to learn these things. And so, as the teacher, you're going to be punishing the learner if the learner gets anything wrong. So all of you go back into the room where the shock apparatus is, where the learner will sit. And they hook the learner up to the shock apparatus. You get a test shock of 15 volts, so you know it's serious. That's, in fact, the only shock that's offered to, that is really administered throughout the whole experiment, is that first 15-volt shock to convince you that it's real. And, of course, the learner has been hired by the experimenter. You go back to the table where this fancy apparatus shock generator sits in front of you with little switches. And the little switches are labeled from in 15-volt increments from 15 all the way up to 450. And you're told that whenever the learner gets something wrong in this parent-associate task, that you're supposed to shock them. And the next time they get something wrong, you're supposed to move up on the scale and shock them. Now, you're not told how long to hold the button down. That's entirely up to you. And, of course, given that the study is about obedience, the experimenter sits in the room, at least in one version. He did about 20 different versions of the study. The experimenter sits in the room, and as you're shocking, if you have any questions, he assures you that no permanent damage is done, although the shocks are very painful, and that you have to continue the study. And he has several prompts that he will give you if you begin to look like you're gonna wimp out on him. So, what I'd like to do with the group, with y'all, is to have all of you volunteer for the study by raising your hand. You don't have to raise it real far, but just raise it part way and assume that you're in the study at the beginning. So if you would, and what I'm going to do is to go through what happened in the study, and I want you to put your hand down when you think you would tell the experimenter that you're out of here, that you're done, that you're not going to continue anymore. Okay?
Except that we don't know that the learner is a hired person.
That's right.
Except that we do.
That's right. Now that you do. Now you do, but I want you to think about how you would behave in this situation.
What if you already know the results of what this is about?
You behave the way you think you'd behave.
Okay.
Brent, pull your hand down when you think you wouldn't shock anymore, when you'd say, I'm done. Okay, so if you will, if you'd all raise your hand, you volunteered for the study. Now, you can drop out just on the very first one if you don't like it. Okay? You can drop out on the very first one. What happens is that the learner makes a mistake, and it's now your turn to shock the learner. And is anybody going to drop out at that point? If you think you would, that's fine. Drop out. So we still got some hands up. The learner is perverse. He keeps making mistakes. You wonder, you know, what's going on with this fellow, but he keeps making mistakes. And you keep having to go up. At some point along here, you hear a shout from him. Now, he's in this room, right? And the door is closed away from you. You hear a shout from him. Ouch! Would anybody drop out at that point? Okay, so we have a few folks dropping out. Any hands still up? Let me go through the whole thing. So all the hands are down now, just for the folks on the table. A few extra shocks later, right, we're now always going up in voltage, so we're now up in the hundreds of volts. You hear the learner shout, "Ouch, that hurt! I want to quit! Let me out! Let me out!" At this point, when I do these things in class, there's another group of people who pull their hands down and say that they would stop at that point. Then, further on, and now we're up in the 200s volts, the learner will shout and say, "My heart is hurting me. You've got to stop. You've got to stop." Now, one of the things that you need to remember is going on in the study. When you say you drop out, the experimenter looks at you and says, the experiment must continue. It's very important for the experiment that you continue. At one point, the experimenter even says to you, you have no choice. You have to continue with the experiment you've started now. At the point where the learner has started shouting about his heart, he's pounding on the wall. Later, he falls completely silent, and you get no noise at all from the other side of the room. So you can see this escalates in the study to a pretty clear indication that the learner is unhappy. He doesn't like what's going on in the study, and perhaps he's even passed out or dead in the other room because you get no noise at all. Well, if we look at the number of people who say that they would continue participating, and this is 100% up at the top, what you find out is that there are these standard cusps, not surprisingly, at the places where the fellow shouts and gets all upset. And most of the people say that they would quit by the time... says, "I'm tired of this, I don't want to participate anymore." That's what people say would happen. In fact, what Milgram found with these are just, well, let's leave the red line up. What Milgram found with these regular folks off the street, like us, is that 2/3 of the people went all the way to 450 volts. It's not actually 2/3, it is 65 point something percent. So you've got the drop off, but then 2/3 of the people went all the way to 450 volts. Now Milgram did a whole bunch of other variations on this to try to figure out what it was that made the situation so powerful that people would continue shocking this person even after they protested and even after it seemed that they might be dead. And again, we can talk about the wide variations that he did to try to figure out what was going on. The only point I want to make with this study is that this is clearly a very powerful situation. When 2/3 of the people, this study, by the way, has been replicated in Europe and in Australia, a whole variety of places. The latest that this has been replicated was in the 70s, partly because it's very hard to get it past ethics committees these days.
That's the key point.
Yeah.
Ethics.
Now, there are other studies that look at obedience in a very similar way and find similar results. So it's not like we've gotten more sophisticated since the 60s. In fact, I suspect if you could disguise this study or do it with people who had not heard of it, you would find similar results today. It's not like we're smarter than we were in the 60s. All you have to do is go ask the people in Bosnia if folks are willing to harm other folks. Or ask some of the racists in the South about that. So here we've clearly got a very powerful situation where most people think they will drop out. And yet, in fact, most people continue and actually do what they think is harm to another person. So the whole point is that situations can be much more powerful than we think they are. Now, it's fascinating to talk about the people who did drop out. There are character differences that we can talk about. But still, when two-thirds of the just regular folks go on, it's hard to just think that two-thirds of the population would do that in a concentration camp. But perhaps they would, given that they've done it in this study. Yeah.
I agree with you on what your comment was, the racists in the South, and what they're the racists from Idaho. They're the racists.
That's right.
From
Aspen. Oh, I pick racists in the South because they're far away from most folks up here, and it's easy for us to decide that they would do such horrible things. that's the only reason I choose them. But you're right.
There are a lot of isolated communities in Montana and Idaho.
That's right.
And the Pacific Northwest as well.
That's right. And the point, in fact, of this study is that just regular folks, not racists, normal people like you and me, would do these kinds of things if we were really pressured. Now, let me assure you that the people who went all the way in the study were not themselves happy about it. Many of them were sweating and were laughing nervously and were clearly very, very agitated and would keep asking the experimenter if it was okay to stop. But when the experimenter said go on, they'd shake their heads and they'd sweat and they'd go on. So it's not like they were blithely killing folks, but they did go on and hurt somebody else, even though they were unhappy about it.
For $5.
That's where the character comes in, because they're discerning the situation based on their character.
Many of them offered to give the money back.
But wasn't there, the Stanley was cited for the unethical treatment of not letting these folks know that it was someone playing the role.
That's right.
After the experiment.
That's right.
And they had to retrieve these people who were committing suicide, who were, you know.
Yeah, actually all of that is myth. Excuse me, misconception. Deanne gets on me for myth. All of that actually is untrue. Psychiatrists have gone back and interviewed these people 4 and 5 years after they were in the study. Many of them say it was a very educational experience for them. They learned a great deal. None of them have any more. There's no more psychopathology in that group than there is in the general population. And most people think that they learned a great deal, that it was quite worthwhile. One person decided to become a conscientious objector in during the Vietnam War because he participated in the study and might then have opted out of being in Company C and participating in the My Lai Massacre.
So,
which is precisely the kind of obedience. I mean, he saw this in the kinds of things that were being asked of him, and he said, I'm out of here. I'm not going to participate in this war. And so, in fact, many people learned a great deal from the study and weren't hurt by it. So there's a great deal of controversy among psychologists about the ethics of the study.
Stanley was the one that they went after.
Yeah, and Stanley Milgram has written a lot of replies to people who didn't like the study, saying, "Hey, look, all the folks who were in the study liked it. What are we supposed to do with that? All of the folks who were in the study thought that it was worthwhile.
But that doesn't make it right, does it?
No, it doesn't.
No.
No, it doesn't. And there's different ways of and in fact, that's one of the replies of the critics of the study. Let me talk about another study that shows the power of the situation. My mentor at Princeton, John Darley, and one of his students did a study with Princeton Seminary students. They brought them over to the psychology building at the university, and they asked them to fill out some questionnaires and to write the text out of a very short talk on one of two topics, and they were randomly assigned which of these topics. One of the topics, I can't remember what the other text was, but one of the topics was the Good Samaritan. So they were going to go give a talk on the Good Samaritan, a very short talk. Once they had done with writing their short talk, the experimenter said to them one of two things. He said, you're going to be recording your talk over in the next building, and well, it looks like you have a little bit of time, so you can just saunter over there and knock on the door and you can get started. To the other half of the people, they said, oh my, you're late. You really need to hurry over there because if you don't get over there soon, we're going to be behind on the schedule. Now, unbeknownst to them, unbeknownst to these seminary students, there was someone lying in the alleyway between the two buildings playing as though they were very ill. And what you found in the study is that the people who were in a hurry to give a talk on the Good Samaritan stepped over the person to go give their talk. And the people who weren't in a hurry, regardless of the topic of their talk, were more likely to stop and help. Now, there are some interesting, again, there's some interesting character issues because some of the personality tests that they gave the Princeton Seminary students, although they didn't predict whether they'd stop or not, they did predict the kind of help they would give or the extent of help they would give. But this is another example of the importance of the situation. In the doing of moral things and the doing of good. Yeah?
Was this a study on altruistic behavior?
Yeah, it was a study on helping. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that with seminary students, it had nothing to do with the things that were going on in their mind at the time. If what they were, because they were thinking about their Good Samaritan talk. And they were stepping over the person in the alleyway. Now, by the way, having lived in Princeton, there are people who sit about in the alleyways in Princeton. It's close enough to New York that you get that. So this wasn't somebody acting sick in an alley in Iowa, in a rural town. But both of those studies suggest that the situation is much more powerful than we're willing to give it credit for.
Or is it more powerful even than anything within us? That's what I'm sensing.
That's a frightening thought,
yeah,
isn't it?
Really disturbing.
Well, one of the things.
What I would do.
Well, it's. I'm glad you're wondering because that's what I wanted to have happen.
Yeah.
Because I wanted you all to wonder what you might do in these situations.
I know.
But you do need to remember that there are people who dropped out of the Milgram study. And there are people who dropped out of the Milgram study early on. One woman who dropped out early on was a recent emigre from Holland, where she had seen the horrors of World War II. And she said, I've seen this, and I am not going to be a part of it. So she had some experience.
My guess is that a lot of that, two-thirds of people who stayed in and were compliant to the end, had good upbringing in terms of were obedient to authority and
yes.
did what their parents told them.
It's what we raise our children
and
to do.
And have pretty structured upbringing. That's
yes.
A, yes.
Yeah. And
you know, we don't assume those
that's right.
two-thirds of those people were bad people. They were probably...
That's right. They were good people.
Many of them that had learned to deal with authority by being compliant and
yeah.
you know, being good citizens. And
so they were being good subjects in Milgram's study. They were doing what the experimenter told them to, even though it was very hard. And they didn't like it. But it was, and it was hard for them to be a good subject, but they persevered to the end.
Did you take this as another step, or maybe he did, but I suspect you could because of your social mm-hmm. inclination, is set 10 or 20 or 40 people in the same room at the same time,
right.
all of them. I mean, so you've got your teachers all pressing the button at the same time and watch how those teachers interact with each other. That's what I'm starting to see when you see groups.
Yes.
See groups of people where 10 or 15 or 20 people have power
mm-hmm. yes.
in some situation, or maybe there's 20 experimenters, or was anything down either of those levels?
Yeah, that's in fact one of the things that Milgram did, is he didn't have that many, because that gets pretty expensive to have that many people. But he would bring three people in. You don't get very many, you don't get much difference with three people. When you do get a difference is, and Milgram set this up himself, he had an additional hired person who played a helper, and the helper at some point in the experiment would say, I'm out of here, I'm not going to continue. And as soon as you got some support, most people would then drop out. So if you, but again, remember, this is the situation,
mm-hmm.
providing them with some support for being good.
Yeah.
Right.
They needed that first brave person to say, "I'm not going to do this."
That's right. They needed one brave person to say, and then they said, "Yes, you're right. This is wrong, and I won't continue."
But you know what's interesting about that, listening to Susan's Bible study this morning and starting to think about conversion isn't just the conversion of the person, but the conversion of the community.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that if one changes, mm-hmm. others come along.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so that change that's worked in us isn't encapsulated in the individual.
Did I pay you to say that? Because that's a wonderful segue to the footnote that I want to give, which is that one of the things that we have, okay, $5. That one of the things that we can take away from this is if we know the situation is powerful as it is, then we ought to be responsible for the situations that we create for ourselves and for other people, which says something about how we ought to run our churches as organizations that produce situations where people are more likely to stand up and say, no, we won't do this evil thing. And in fact, much of the research on the building of character, the building of morality, shows that people build morality, people build their own moral fiber by saying to themselves, I'm the kind of person who helps others, or having that said to them in a group. And so when we gather as a church and we say, as a church, we are the kind of people who help others. We are willing to work for the poor. We are willing to give money. We are willing to stand up against unfair or immoral government practices. What we're doing is creating a situation that helps us to have good character. And so And so I'm not suggesting the character isn't important, but what I am suggesting is that there's a back door to it, and that the situational influences are much more powerful. And that instead of ignoring them, see, we don't have language for situations. We don't talk about, how do we talk about a moral church? Or a moral group? It's hard to. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to talk about an honest person. Yes.
I think that the language of sanctuary, for example, the language of creating a safe place.
Yes.
As a community with a self-understanding, and to be intentional about that as a part of your sense of who you are, your self-definition.
Yes.
The kind of language you reach for to describe that the church is sanctuary, not just for people who are political prisoners, but sanctuary for children, sanctuary for people who are vulnerable.
Yes, for the outcast.
Right, and I think the second thing that's happened is that the assumed integrity of authority figures, we're facing times when we are in a crisis for authority and integrity.
That's right.
We've given that away. Mm-hmm. And people have not been safe. People have been abused. People have been misused. Systems have been abused. Mm-hmm. And so people say, gee, how could that happen? We would expect that in the world, but we wouldn't expect that in our church. And I think that your warning, the fact is that we need to be clear that these situations, by default, inattention, assumption,
yes,
lack of an intention, to be clear, and
yes,
to confront each other, that we need to work towards sanctuary and parishes.
And one of the things we need to do is to covenant with each other to create those situations that will help all of us be the kind of people that we want to be.
Right.
And it's a very difficult thing to do, partly because we don't have language for it. And you're suggesting some. I like it.
Right.
Sanctuary. And in fact, language like that was used by the village of Le Chambon in France that helped many, many Jews escape from the Nazi Holocaust.
Right.
So one of our jobs is to try intentionally to create that, instead of focusing entirely on personal moral character. We focus on corporate moral character.
Right.
And it's a very different way of thinking about character, to think of it as a corporate thing, as a characteristic of a group of people.
That adds the church, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Right, right.
That's right. Well, and we can think. Let's take the Nazi organization, mm-hmm, to kill Jews. What you've got is an immoral organization. Mm-hmm. Eichmann didn't have actually to kill anybody, and in fact, he was sickened when they took him to the camps. All he had to do was fill out order forms and push papers and do deadlines. And the people who were actually doing the killing had the excuse that they were following orders.
Mm-hmm.
And so responsibility was fragmented across. And the organization was set up. And in fact, Eichmann talks about having set the organization up to fragment responsibility. Deanne, you were going to say something?
I was just going to say, I think it's the same, it's the reverse of the same dynamic, that having one person set a good example that encourages others is not unlike what you just described. That,
yes.
And I'm trying to remember Niebuhr's argument about moral man and immoral society, almost that the group, in some ways, the group removes responsibility from us, allows us to do evil
That's right.
things, and say, it's not mine. You know, and Chuck and I teach together at a college, and I'm sure everyone has in their own work situations are times when you think it's easier to follow the rules.
Yeah.
It's easier to just say, I'm sorry, you didn't do what you were told to do, that's it. And not just stop and ask yourself when the rules are against what you want to carry out.
Yeah.
And the group can support you either in keeping the rules or in being generous.
Compassionate
or whatever it is, the value that the rules are supposed to be set up to produce.
That's right. Yeah.
But what happens when you work for a corporate organization that's not church related?
That's right.
That is profit making.
That's right.
That is out to be number one in the country.
Yeah.
And then they have their rules and regulations, and you rock the boat because ethically and morally you cannot take it, and your coworkers are not supporting you on it.
That's right. And what? In fact, you know, I teach courses in ethics to computer science students. And this is precisely the question they ask when they go work for IBM or for any other large organization that fragments responsibility. I mean, any large organization to produce a big piece of software has to fragment responsibility or you don't ever get it done. And I work with them hoping that one day they'll become managers and think like this instead of, and think about ways that together they can make even people who are far removed from, we call them the users, even people who are far removed from the users of the software have some responsibility for the outcome.
But the other side of it is that what you were talking about earlier, no one's total character is in just that workplace.
That's right.
I mean, I know a lot of people in that workplace that maybe have to do some of that functioning, but it does not describe their total character.
That's right.
Right, right.
That's right. And in fact, many of my colleagues in the computer science industry work for an organization that fragments responsibility, that may do bad things, and then they go use their expertise to help organizations like Holden put together databases, et cetera. So you can't call them bad people, but you can call it a bad organization. You can call it an immoral organization.
A couple of times we talked about rules and following those, and one would hope that in the church we all have some say in the rules so that it's not an imposition, somebody defining. Because we talk about we being a community, and I think one of the things that makes Holden function is that everybody talks about what they can bring to this community.
Yes.
Do we do that in our church? We've gotten to the corporate model of saying, well, I'm in charge. You're going to do this and this and this.
And there's a person in charge of youth ministry and a person
exactly.
in charge of food services and a person in charge of... Right.
Rather than saying, yes, all those things may still function, but what is it that I bring to the community and celebrate that, and therefore we define
that's
the community
right.
together and the rules.
That's one very good, you know, that's sort of the democratic process is one very good approach. However, it's also possible to do it even in a hierarchical organization. It's still possible to keep each other accountable for the outcomes of the things we do in a hierarchy.
And there have been corporations done studies within units or management units who work together at their particular section of this whole whatever. They're the functioning units.
Right. And, you know, when I go talk with people in organizations, I try to point that out because very often they think that what I want to do is to turn them into a commune.
Yeah.
And I don't. What I want them to do, though, is for everybody to think more globally than they have been in the past.
That's why I quit my job.
because you were, and in fact, that may have been the very best thing, that may have been the most moral thing that you could do, is to quit an organization that wouldn't allow you to be moral in the work that you did. It's a very hard choice to make.
It is.
It's a very difficult choice to make.
I think it's one the church has struggled with from the outset. About are there kinds of work that Christians cannot do?
Right.
Are there kinds of activities?
Like work for defense organizations.
Right. Can you be a soldier and be a Christian?
Right.
Can you be this and be a Christian? And I think the other piece of that that's maybe even more difficult than employment, although employment is not certainly an easy question, is then if our character isn't unitary, and I know this is one of your other topics, is morality relative.
is
evil relative? Or, you know, do you simply say, well, character isn't unitary, and there are some things about us that are good, and there are some things about us that are bad, and so you find out that the drunk is really trustworthy and give him the job of sleeping in the kitchen, and don't worry about the rest of it. What do you do about
right.
the rest of it?
Uh-huh. Right. Well, yeah, I, that's a very good point. What I don't want the conversation that we've had to suggest that what we do is let those parts of our character slide that we think we ought to be able to improve on. What I would like to suggest is that the best way we could improve on those parts of our character is by doing it corporately with other people's support, rather than being the brave hermit who goes out into the desert and is moral and is a sort of heroic spiritual virtuoso. Most of us aren't going to be able to do that. We can only be spiritual with the support of other people who will help us.
One of the problems that I struggle with is this business of the character flaw, this business of the complexity of character, is that on the other hand, in a system or an organization where a person has a great impact on the lives of people, vis-a-vis Eichmann or whatever,
yeah.
that there is incumbent upon that, whatever gate you're keeping, how many people you have affected.
Yes. There's a great responsibility for leaders and organizations.
That's right.
And if you understand this model.
That's right. And therefore,
that's right.
It's this business of morality is that I guess I'm coming from the side of where we see people at those gates who then fall from grace or something occurs. That's about was a character flaw.
That's right, we blame them.
Nobody's perfect, or whatever it is. And it seems to me that somehow there has to be a balance of the moral responsibility of the community so
yes.
we hold people in check and don't put them out there as lone rangers with this power.
That's right.
And on the other hand, there is more expected of a person who's at an important gate.
That's right.
And if you're not willing to step into that, embrace that and receive
that's
it,
right.
then you shouldn't be at that gate.
And when you become part of any community, you get responsibility for the moral climate of that community, whether you're low in the hierarchy, or whether you're at the very top,
right.
there is always some responsibility.